Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great.
You know, I was thinking this afternoon, I wonder when was the last time you and I talked, and I still haven't been able to come up with a date.
Well, Bay Area guys, we've ran across each other a few times.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, that friendship we had, I see Roy Eisenhardt. He does a segment, matter of fact, here on the network called The Legal Side of Sports, because he's teaching law and sports over at the University of California. But, you know, he's been a dear friend for so many years. And when I talked to Dave Stewart, I said, Dave, I really would need to get a hold of Dave Henderson, because the Library of Congress asked me, Dave, to put together a collection. I mean, I've been doing this for 27 years, to put together a collection of outstanding athletes for the Library of Congress. And so I wanted to have you in that collection so that family and friends will forever be able to hear you talk about your life and about your career. So that's why I reached out to you the way I did.
All right. Yeah. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Are you still up in Seattle or?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Seattle, working with the Mariners and A's, matter of fact.
So. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, what I'll do is I have a brother that's over in Bellevue. Well, next time I come up, I'll give you a call in advance and let's try to grab lunch or dinner one night.
Sounds good. Yeah. I'm right here in Seattle, West Seattle. So
okay.
Real close. Everything's close.
Okay, I'm ready to roll here. We'll do two segments with you. Here we go. Dave Henderson joins us on Sports Byline. Fine center fielder who played 14 years with Seattle, Boston, the Giants, Oakland, and Kansas City. And he went to the World Series four times during his career, once with Boston in 86 and three straight years with the Oakland A's between 88 and 90. And he got a World Series championship ring in 1989 when the A's swept their Bay Area rivals, the Giants. You grew up in California. You went to high school at Dos Palos High School in California. Tell me a little bit about the town you grew up in, Dave.
I think I have the same story as everybody. I come from a small town of about 2,000 people, and we're mostly football players in Central California and farmers. And I looked at my mom and dad working hard, and I figured I better get a scholarship so I don't have to work that hard. So I was a pretty good football player coming out of high school and got a scholarship pretty much anywhere in the country. And these Mariners baseball people came to call, and they said they wanted to draft me to play baseball. And me being a pretty smart kid saying, okay, a college scholarship worth about 40 grand. They're going to give you a couple hundred grand. Do the math. Take a shot. You can always go back and play football. So that started my career with the Mariners in 1977. The first pick ever by the Mariners, by the way.
Yeah, what was that organization like in those early days?
Well, there wasn't an organization. I started it. It was an expansion club, and they had to pick somebody, and so they went with Dave Henderson, their first pick ever.
Yeah, when you think about it, though, I mean, what were they, you know, I think about the old early days of the American Football League, and I hear the war stories about them. Was it a kind of feel your way along with a new expansion franchise up in Seattle? Because Seattle had a little bit of history with baseball, but really this was kind of a rebirth of baseball in the Northwest.
Yeah, I think the Seattle Pilots had left and went to Milwaukee. And so it was strange for all of us kids because, you know, there was 200 of us. And I was doing the math, and only 25 guys can be on a roster. So some older kid, 25-year-old, said, you know, you're the number one draft pick. You don't have to worry about making this team, kid. They're going to keep you. And that's when I kind of settled into it. But we only had a short A ball team and a triple A team. We had no A ball team, double A, and things like that. So it was just the beginning of everything. So we were the newborns of the American League.
You know what's interesting about that, Dave? You know as well as I do that most established organizations, they have a system. You know, if you're in the Dodger organization, you do it the Dodger way. But when you've got an expansion franchise, you don't have an organization. You don't have a particular system. So who mentored you along the way?
Well, I think you're exactly right. That's what happened. We had a bunch of guys from Kansas City. The Kansas City Academy was established in that time, and that's the way they ran their minor leagues and their programs. The Academy from Kansas City, the Hal McRae's, the George Brett's, those guys grew up learning baseball that way. And so that's how we grew up copying the Kansas City Academy way, and that's what the Seattle Mariners were all about in those days.
What was your first year in the major leagues? I was trying to recall this afternoon.
It's a funny story because I got there in 1981. And, of course, if you're a bright-head kid and you've done all your due diligence, you've went to single A, double A, triple A, and you've advanced, you get to the major leagues, you're going to make spring training out of, make the team out of spring training. And a week before we left camp, they said, we're going on strike. And I said, oh, I don't want to go on strike. I just got to the big leagues. But, you know, in 1981, we went on strike, and that was a split season year. So my career started with a strike in 81 and ended in a strike in 94.
Do you remember, Dave, when you started to feel really comfortable about playing at the major league level? Because I remember asking a number of pitchers, do you remember the moment you went from being a thrower to being a pitcher? But since you were a position player, tell me about when you really felt comfortable being in the major leagues.
Well, I think it's after you get knocked down a few pegs because, you know, we're all the all-state and greatest athletes in the world. But once you get to competition that's better than you or equal to you, that the game gets tougher. And my first year I got sent out during that strike, and then I came back up. And that's when I realized that I need to work harder and take care of the details of baseball. I was always good enough, but there's so much work that goes into being a good baseball player that people don't realize. I always laugh at the fact that people say Ken Griffey Jr., he just fell out of bed and played baseball. But I got a chance to see how much he really worked at it.
Yeah, when you look at Ken Griffey Jr., and I remember watching him in his early days up in Seattle, there was something that was unique. And over the years of sports broadcasting, I've seen the John Elways, I've done their games, and I've seen others athletes like that had great success. What is it that they all do? Is it a natural ability, and they make it look easier than it actually is, Dave?
Well, of course they have natural ability, but they refine it, and they lie. What Griffey always says is, you know, I don't stretch, I don't do this, I don't lift weights, but he did everything. He did everything to be a better ball player, and he took care of details, and he just lied to the public and said, I just get out of bed and play baseball, to keep it simple.
Nobody does that. You and I both know that. You went from Seattle, which was kind of an expansion franchise and an outpost in baseball, to the Boston Red Sox. Now, I was a sportscaster in Boston, and the only thing I ever feared when I went to Boston on television was that some little old lady up in Maine was going to get all over me if I said Carl Yastrzemski was hitting 332 and he was actually hitting 333. So you know as well as I do how serious they take their baseball. What was that like for you, that transition?
Well, it was coming from little time to the big time, basically. And, you know, they're in a pennant race, and this is the 86 playoffs and World Series. But I guess the most problem I have, I'm a California kid, and we don't do jinxes. Everything is real where we come from. And everybody tried to con me into this Babe Ruth jinx when I got to Boston. And I said, well, we had Notre Dame that said we're going to be in, you know, oceanfront property, Reno, and that never happened. So I don't believe in jinx. And they say, well, you know, the Babe Ruth jinx, you know, this and that. And I go, oh, it's a bunch of crap. And but, you know, you tell a Bostonian that their jinx stuff is a bunch of crap, it doesn't go over very well. And once I started playing in the playoffs and World Series, they figured out I could care less about a jinx.
Tell me about the first time you ever walked in and played in Fenway Park, whether with Seattle or certainly with Boston.
Well, I guess the first thing is you always notice the history and that big green monster. And being a right-handed hitter, you always go, oh, that's very inviting. But then you get out in the outfield, and the park is so small, it's kind of boring. Because for a center fielder, you like to run things down, make great catches. But the ball just hits the wall, and you're thrown into second base. It got boring, but hitting home runs, hitting them over the screen and over the big monster, that's always a thrill. And everybody's been, you know, 7 years old in their backyard and saying, you know, 3-2 count, you get to hit a home run in the World Series and hit it over the green monster. And, hey, I've actually done it in real life.
How was Boston during 86? Because that's the year they went to the World Series against the Mets. And I know how their fan base can be, but during the course of going to a World Series, and you pointed out they had not gone and won a World Series since the early 1900s, tell me what that atmosphere was like that season when you were there.
Well, everybody was apprehensive. They were, I think they were scared, and Everybody was talking about the jinx and things like that. And you know, me, I'm just a baseball player. I'm a real guy. You either do or you don't, as they say, and you get the job done. But in Boston, the fans were always apprehensive. Something's going to happen bad. Something's going to happen bad. And I go, why would you think that? You know, because everybody was predisposed with this jinx thing. And once we got to the World Series, and by the way, I had a pretty good series. So I was feeling pretty good about myself. And we ended up losing, and everybody says, okay, now do you believe in the jinx? And I said, no, we lost a baseball game. You either lose or you win. It's that simple. But they never convinced me about this jinx Babe Ruth stuff. So,
in about 45 seconds, tell me about the catalyst for that season. What was the key to them making it to the World Series in 86?
Of course, you got to have a great pitcher. Roger Clemens was our ace, and he dominated every time he went it out. You know, I don't know how many wins. He went over 20 wins. But, you know, we had the core, Jim Rice and Wade Boggs and players like that, Dwight Evans, that provided the offense. But we were basically a really, really good team. And, you know, me adding, you always got to have the guy that goes beyond the call of duty, and apparently I did, and it tipped the scales.
Dave Henderson has joined us on Sports Byline. Center fielder in the major leagues for 14 years, started out with Seattle, first draft choice ever by the Seattle Mariners, and then Boston, went to Boston, was in the World Series in 1986 when they went up against the New York Mets, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. Also played for the Giants, but had great success later in his career with the Oakland A's, going to three straight World Series, and also played for Kansas City toward the end of the World Series. And on the way to his first World Series with Boston in 1986, they went up against the Angels, and he was the catalyst for the Boston Red Sox in that series, particularly in game number 5, and we'll talk to him about that as we continue with more of you and Sports Byline. Dave Henderson has joined us on Sports Byline USA. We're talking about his fine 14-year career with the Boston Red Sox. He goes to his first World Series. That was 1986. And take me through that series and leading up to game number 5, which was really the key point and the turning point in that series, Dave.
Well, you got to remember, I was a backup player to Tony Armas in center field. I was more of a defensive player for insurance purposes. And Tony Armas went on the wall and twisted his ankle in about the 5th inning. And I'm coming into the ball game, and this is game 5, and we're down by a couple of runs in the playoffs. And the weird thing about it is Bobby Gritch, a real good friend of mine, hit a ball off the wall, and it went off my glove for a 2-run home run. It put the Angels ahead. And I thought I was the GOAT because, remember, if you're the defensive guy, you go over the wall, you're supposed to catch the ball. And I didn't. But all turned out well because I come up in the, you know, 9th inning. And as every little kid wants to think about, you get to hit a home run and win the game. And, of course, I hit a 2-run home run to put us ahead to come back and get that victory in game 5. And after that, there was no contest. We went back to Boston and beat the Angels, you know, I don't know, 100-0 in 2 ball games. So, so there was no contest after that.
On that home run pitch, were you looking for a particular pitch from Donnie Moore?
No. When you're a baseball player and you're a backup player, when you're only playing, you know, 3 innings a night and you're getting an AB off the closer every night, you don't have much of a chance as a hitter. And I think I was just up there trying to survive. And once I fouled off a couple of fastballs, I knew I was in trouble. And a short story is I got 2-2 count, and I looked around the field, and everybody was in their starting blocks, like the track meet to run out on the field. And I started thinking, how am I going to get to the dugout, you know, when I strike out? Because, you know, you don't have much chance of a closer when you're a backup player. And then I noticed, I go, oh, I got a bat in my hand. I got no problem getting to the dugout with a bat in my hand. I'm going to take a few people out after I strike out. But, you know, he threw a couple more fastballs and did a split finger that I got out in front of it, hit out of the ballpark, and, you know, the rest is history.
Everybody pretty much knows the story. Donnie Moore sometime later then committed suicide, and a lot of people say it had to do with that home run that you hit off of him. I don't buy into that theory, and I read the story in Sports Illustrated that was the in-depth look at all that went on with that. What thoughts did you have after all of that came down on him?
Well, the thing about it was I was kind of boxed into a corner because I knew he had problems, alcohol, drugs, and, you know, marital problems and things like that. But I look like a jerk if I come out and tell the truth on his life versus, you know, him committing suicide. So I kept my mouth shut for, it's been 20 years now. And his wife came out and told the whole story in Sports Illustrated, which was a big burden off me because I used to go to restaurants, me and my wife, and people used to whisper, that's the guy that killed Donnie Moore. You know, that's upsetting to her because, you know, you don't want people saying that in restaurants. And of course, I knew the truth, had nothing to do with baseball. You know, real life kills people, not baseball. But it's a big relief in our household that this real story came out, you know, 20 years later.
What you're being modest about is the fact that you were really the catalyst for them doing the turnaround and going on and making it to the World Series, because the Angels come back to tie it up at 6-6 in the bottom of the ninth, but in the 11th inning, you hit the sacrifice fly that would prove to be the margin of victory. When you look back about going to the World Series, do you take some sense of satisfaction, Dave, in helping to get the team there?
Of course. I mean, every ball player wants to do his part and, you know, contribute. And I can say from the bottom of my heart that, you know, I did everything possible for us to go to the World Series, to win a World Series. And people always ask me to compare home runs, the one in Game 5, in the ninth inning versus the one in Game 6 of the World Series in the 10th inning. And I always say the difference is there's a guy basically pinch hitting in Game 5, just swinging, and there's a guy in the World Series that's hitting about 400 and has his stroke, and the other team is trying to stay away from him. That's a bigger home run in my book when they're trying to stay away from you and not let you hit home run, and you do it in the 10th inning to win a World Series.
Okay, let me take you into the World Series 1986 against the Mets. I'm going to go right to the game number 6, which was played in New York against the Mets. And I know where I was, and I think there are certain things that happen in sports, Dave, over the years where you remember where you were when Cal Ripken Jr. broke the record, that sort of thing. And I was in a restaurant on Pier 39 having dinner, and I looked up, and I saw the ball go right through Bill Buckner's legs. And it just took the breath out of me. What was it like for the Boston Red Sox when that happened?
Well, I think as players on that field, we like to start a little bit earlier than the ball going through Bill Buckner's legs. Remember, we had a 2-run lead,
right,
with 2 outs,
right,
with nobody on base before all that happened. And I'm sitting out there in center field watching all these base hits and things like that and saying, wait a minute. What happened to our bullpen? So they scored 2 runs and tied it up. And I knew we were in trouble because we had used most of our bullpen to keep the game tied. And then the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs and they win. So it was kind of weird that everybody blamed Bill Buckner when it's a team sport. And our bullpen, you know, gave up the 2 runs. But you know, everybody remembers the Bill Buckner thing because that's what everybody focused on. But as a team, we all noticed that our bullpen gave up those 2 runs with 2 outs in the 10th inning.
I had the opportunity to have both Mookie Wilson and Bill Buckner with me on the show at the same time. And it was wonderful to see, first of all, the friendship that those two had and then listen quietly to the perspective that they each had. And I thought, you know, after it was over with, Dave, it gave me such great insight to what you athletes are really, really like. I mean, the fans and the media and everybody, you know, they dissect everything, but they forget one thing. All of you are human beings trying to give the best that you can at the particular moment. We know that the Mets came back. They win that World Series. Let me go fast forward in your career when you end up with the Oakland A's. That's where our friendship started. You signed as a free agent in Oakland in 1988. You set career highs in batting average, .304, runs 100 hits, 154, and you also hit 24 home runs that season. You kind of blossomed a little bit late in your career. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it's more playing time. The Seattle days, you know, when you lose 100 games, you don't get to play August and September. They bring up the kids and let them have tryout camps. So you have, we call it 4.5 month stats. When I got to Oakland, we were in a pennant race, and I got to play the full year. And, of course, when you're around guys like, you know, Canseco, McGuire, all your numbers are going to be better because there's more people on base when you hit. It's that simple. But I was in my hometown. I'm from Dos Palos, an hour and a half away from Oakland. My family got to watch me. My whole town came to see me. You play in Oakland. So it was a very, very comfortable environment for me to play in.
When I think back about those Oakland A's teams, because I had just come to the Bay Area myself a couple of years earlier, and you were a part of three Oakland A's teams that went to the World Series. You beat the Giants in 89, lost to the Dodgers in 88, and Cincinnati then the following year after beating the Giants. I don't know how to quite describe it. I've tried to describe to people what that group of athletes being down at spring training in particular, and you had Mark McGuire, you had Jose, you had Dwayne Murphy, you had Ricky Henderson, you had the pitching staff with Dave Stewart. I mean, can you put it into perspective what that group of athletes were like?
Well, I think it was one of the best collective athletes and teams in a long time, because when you look at that team, we had 12 to 13 all-stars on the team. And we all look back today and we always say, wow, how did we lose? It's weird how baseball works. And from us, we know that the best team doesn't always win. That's why we love sports. You cannot predict it. Because when we start thinking about us against the Dodgers, you know, it shouldn't have been that close. You know, the Nasty Boys with Cincinnati, they beat us. You know, it shouldn't have been that close. But this is baseball. You can't predict it. When you have 12 All-Stars on a team, you're probably supposed to win. But we look back on that, and we regret that we only won one World Series in that time period, when we had a collective of 12 All-Stars on a team.
Talk to me a little bit about the chemistry and just the personality of those teams, because when I think back, knowing Ricky Henderson, knowing yourself, knowing Dwayne Murphy, Dave Stewart, Jose Canseco, and all of the guys there, it was such a different group of guys personality-wise. You go down to spring training and you see Jose's red-hot, souped-up car, and he's out on the town late at night, and then there's Mark McGuire and everything. What was the personality like and the feeling in the clubhouse?
Well, you hit it right on the head. We had a lot of different personalities, but I think one thing we had was myself, Carney Lansford, and Dave Stewart. We were kind of subdued captains. I took care of the outfielders. Carney took care of the infielders, and Stu took care of the pitchers. But I had a load. I had Canseco and Ricky to take care of. And our boss, of course, La Russa, every time they did something, he got mad at me. But that's the way it worked. But we found a way to get it done. We were wild, crazy. We were a band on tour, basically. We went to hotels and things, and everybody wanted to see us. But the good thing about it, you remember, baseball is entertainment. We were very entertaining. We had a lot of personalities. We hit home runs. We pitched. We played defense. And we had a little a pizzazz, a little hot dog about us. So the fans loved us. And when we traveled, the other cities loved us because we were going to show you something that you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, you guys were rock stars. There were no doubt about it. And when you came to town, it was like rock stars coming to town. The one thing I always wondered about was Tony La Russa, knowing his personality, which is a button-down kind of drill sergeant, serious personality. How did he coexist with all of this?
Well, I had to break him down a little bit because, as you know, I once got traded because I smiled too much. So he didn't like that at all. But I told him, it's okay to smile. You can be serious about your job. But we're best of friends now. Over the years, he hated me when I played against him because, you know, you hit a home run in ninth inning to beat the other team. and you smile, the other manager's not going to like you. But we became great friends, and he respected my game. He respected my work ethic, and he figured out that smiling was okay, as long as you do your job. But like I said, I kept control over Canseco and Ricky and the other outfielders, and we had one thing in common. We did whatever it took that day to win a game, and that was our main focus. You know, all these rules and all that stuff, and you know how guys have to look down at third base and get signs and all that? We didn't have all that stuff. We just played baseball. Do whatever it took that day to win a ball game, and that's what Tony respected.
We have 45 seconds left, Dave, and when you think back on your fine 14-year career, is there one particular moment that's kind of engraved in Dave Henderson's mind?
Well, it's not really baseball. I think my birthday is July 21st, and I was at the Coliseum one time, and, you know, when you're a baseball player, it's a grind every day, and you don't realize it's your birthday, and all of a sudden, you know, 15 or 20 people start lighting candles, you know, singing me happy birthday. And then another pitch came by, it was a couple hundred. Another pitch went by, there was 10,000 people in the bleacher in Oakland with candles and lighters singing me happy birthday. And that's just something I'll never, ever forget. And they stopped the game, and it was like a chorus of 10,000 people singing you happy birthday. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is awfully cool. Dave, I want to thank you. I appreciate our friendship. I always enjoyed spending time with you talking baseball, but just talking about life in general. Thank you for joining us here on Sports Byline. Take care, my friend.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dave Henderson with us again. Fine center fielder who played 14 years, starting out with Seattle as their top draft choice, then went on to Boston and played in his first of four World Series. That was back in 1986 against the New York Mets, and then a brief time with the Giants. But his most success came with the Oakland A's, as you heard him say. I got a lot of playing time at that time, and he went to three straight World Series, winning one of them. That was during the Earthquake World Series against the crosstown San Francisco Giants. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.